Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be back here in Toronto. This, of course, is home for me. This stage is where we had our grad recitals and our composition concerts. It's also nice to have a little bit of water in the room. It reminds me of Vancouver. It's a very damp city. When we first moved there 3 years ago so that I could pursue studies there, I have two little daughters, 5 and 3 years old, and my wife and I piled into the car and drove across the country. When we arrived in Vancouver, it started raining a week after we got there and didn't really stop until 3 or 4 months later. So it's a little bit of water from the bathroom is something that I can handle. So it's a great privilege to speak here today. I feel honored by the invitation, and I hope that I can share with you some helpful tips as to how to interpret what I've written for the New Zealand String Quartet and James Campbell. When James asked me to write a piece for this concert, it was almost a year ago, I wanted to write something that reflected my experience of living in Vancouver. I had never really spent much time on the West Coast, and so in many ways I think of myself as someone who identifies still with Ontario as home. I wanted my experience on the West Coast to somehow make a mark on my artistic voice. And so I set about the process of trying to find what it is that's unique about the West Coast. I'm just curious, how many of you have lived in Vancouver? Oh wow, that's a whole bunch. And how many have visited for a holiday at all? I mean, it's a nice place. It's very pretty. Oh my goodness. On a fine day, that's right. That's true. I had a discussion with my advisor, Stephen Chapman, around May, after being there for the first year, and he pointed out that, so now the cherry trees will blossom, and you'll feel better. And it's true. It's like the whole place just comes alive around May. Anyway, so I went about searching for uniquely Western aesthetic ideas. What is it about that place that draws people to it, and what often I think people go away from the West Coast and from Vancouver feeling renewed spiritually because of the landscape, the ocean, the mountain vista. And so I wanted to somehow, in my music, reflect that, find it, what is the essence of that. And so this search led me, of course, to a lot of walks in the rain, and also I discovered that I started to like rain a lot. In fact, I started to notice the different kinds of rain and how I got myself a good pair of rubber boots and a big umbrella and would go for daily walks in the rain. And I actually discovered after talking to people that people do this all the time, that people like walking in the rain. And so I would go into, for example, Pacific Rim Park. How many of you know Pacific Rim Park? It's an enormous park that is in the city, and it gives you the impression that you're in complete wilderness. And it's right in the middle of the city. It like separates UBC campus from the rest of the population. And I would frequently go for walks in this woods and listen to the pitter-patter on the canopy of the trees. The echo of sounds in this immense cathedral of natural forest. Hemlock trees are unbelievable. The sort of grandeur of gesture that as a tree, you know, skyrockets towards the top of the canopy. And what I found is that I started to listen to the birds because they echo so clearly in this hemlock cathedral. So I started transcribing the bird calls and took an interest in you know the hobby, and found lots of other people who did as well. I was also sadly confronted with the reality that UBC is a very successful university, and because of that they build a lot of buildings, and buildings are very loud to build. And if you're a composer and you live on the campus, it's difficult to get anything done, because you're constantly listening to the sound drilling. So I've been thinking lately I need to write some cathartic music with titles like The Drilling Outside My Window, or Excavation Sonata Number 5 or something. But so I very much treasured quiet places. And so the Museum of Anthropology became, in many ways, one of these quiet places for me. In addition to the forest and Wreck Beach, which has other advantages, if you've ever been there. But the Museum of Anthropology is this incredibly quiet place most of the time. Mostly because it's an undiscovered secret. And I had a student card, and I could go every day for free. So I did, and I was drawn to the centerpiece of that museum, which of course is Bill Wray's sculpture, The Raven and the First Men. That sculpture is, I'm sure, something you've seen. It's become ubiquitous in our Canadian culture. It's seen on television often, it's been on stamps, and of course it's on our money. It's on the back of the $20 bill. So this intrigued me. I thought, wow, there's something here. Why is it that this image, of all images, has become so ubiquitously Canadian? And what is it about the West Coast that's reflected in this artwork? So I went about investigating Bill Reid as a way of finding inspiration for my music, because I found that Bill Reid, in many ways, became like my art teacher, like a translator for Northwest Coast culture. Bill Reid was uniquely situated in many ways to play that role. Because of his background, his mother was Haida, and his father was Scottish-American. And so he was raised on Victoria Island, essentially in the school system, like many of us would have been. But he really, really dug throughout his life. He strove to uncover the roots of his Haida ancestry. And in that process, of course, he was, you know, a revisionist historian. You know, he invented history, because what else could he do? But he also acted as this translator, this person for me who could convey to me what some of these things meant, these mysteries that surrounded me in my everyday walks. So let's have a look then. I have some pictures that I've taken from the Museum of Anthropology, and some of you will recognize some of this. Bill Reid, by the way, was, Bill Reid, by the way, was an interesting personality, too. His creativity, in many ways, manifested itself in a kind of clown-like or trickster-like attitude. He was a little bit cynical, and he would make jokes in his art that were, a little bit, not everyone would get them. And this was a part of his personality. And so this kind of disruptive, slightly trickster-like, raven-like personality, in many ways I came to discover was what is really behind his creative genius. So here we go. This is a picture of the sculpture, and it tells a story. It's not really my story to tell, right, because it's a Haida story, but the sculpture itself conveys it to us. The title, Raven and the First Men, well, obviously it's about the first men. And we have this enormous clamshell with these incredible lines going, you know, meticulously, like, sculpted with even curvatures moving outward. And then this hand clawing its way out. This character looking very, very determined, trying to make his way out of the clamshell. And beneath the clamshell, we have sand. The tour guide told me that this sand is all the way from Haida Gwaii, and that some school children brought it and put it there. Then there's this face, which I find very mysterious. And above that face, we see some feathers. The hands of this character are much more gentle. They grasp firmly, but not desperately. And then, of course, we have Bill Reid's self-portrait. Bill Reid was, as I mentioned, a trickster. I think he would have found great pleasure in knowing that his self-portrait is on the $20 bill. And he's trying to get back into the clamshell because he thinks it's better than there. It's more cozy, more food. Then another hand grasping firmly over the clamshell. And a wide-eyed face. Shock. and a mouth that's open. What could that be? I spent a lot of time looking at that mouth. Is it the first words? Raven in the first words? The first song? Is it a scream? Or is it a song of joy? And then another hand that's very tightly wrapped around the top of the clamshell. Then this guy looks kind of curious, and his proportions are kind of odd. He has big ears and, again, wide eyes, but his body is tiny, and his hands are small. It's almost like he's a baby, but with a very mature face. That, again, is a kind of enigma in the sculpture. Again, you can see the base of the clamshell and the meticulous care with which each chisel mark was placed. And the foot of the baby. Then we see the hair of another character, again, carved with incredible precision. And this hair eventually leads to another child figure. And this child is wrapped up very cozy in the little corner of the clamshell. Just happy. Sleeping. Reminds me of my own two little girls. Then above that, we see something a little bit scary. And it makes us wonder, well, why are these faces that are looking out at us, why do they look so concerned? Well, it could be because they're seeing the world for the first time. That's a little scary. But also, it could be because of something else. Another wing. Gives you an idea of the proportions. So if that's the wingtip, that raven must be quite big. Big enough to eat me. Which, of course, he would probably happily do because he is very hungry. Now, in the next little vignette, we'll see a close-up of one of the faces. Yeah. So this guy intrigues me. Now turn my head upside down. So I'm looking at this face as if I were hanging from the ceiling. By the way, can everyone see that? Are you over here able to see what's projected there? Because I can move. The thing that fascinates me about this face is that it looks perhaps wise and noble. His nose is very long, but his eyes are not round. That's a bit of a shock because mostly the eyes are round in the sculptures that Bill Rees does, right? So it's very unusual for him to represent the eyes in this way. So maybe he's a conniving fellow, you know? Maybe he's got schemes, maybe he's got plans to do something big. And he's got big ears, disproportionately large to his eyes. And then his mouth is kind of the lip turned down in determination. Mm-hmm. I'm getting out of this clamshell. I'm going to be the first one. Okay, so here's this guy who is, now again, I'm hanging from the ceiling, looking down at him. And we see that here how the eyes are normally represented, the perfect circles. And this was something that tipped me off to an important feature of this sculpture and of Northwest Coast art in general, is the circle. If you look at the sculpture from a distance, you start to realize that it's a whole massive sequence of ellipses. The clam itself, of course, is an ellipse, and we kind of just did a circle around it. The whole shape itself is an oval, and the faces are ovals, and of course the eyes. And that became very significant for the piece of music that I wrote. A lot of circular imagery came up in what I was working with. And you'll see that in the score in a minute when I show it to you. It's kind of mesmerizing. And then the next figure that I'll show you in a moment, we finished our little tour around this guy's expression. Oh, and of course the museum in the background, someone taking a photograph. and the sand that's all around. Okay. So that face looked pretty scared to me. And the reason, of course, is because of this. That's one reason to be afraid. Here's another one. Ouch! And then, of course, the eye of the raven. Again, that round eye. Enormous beak. Very imposing and disproportionately large sculpted figure from the other side. The shape of the eye. A hunched back. And the markings on the wing, which are very consistent with the tradition of totemic art. Okay, so that gives you a bit of an idea of what the sculpture looks like, and as if you just visited the museum. I want to take a moment to look at this character. This is by far the most fascinating one to me. So, Raven and the First Men. I mean, I kind of got a chuckle. It's Raven and the First Men at the women's music club. Do you think this is a man? Doesn't look like a man to me. The features are very, very rounded. The lips are broad. The cheekbones look very feminine to me. And the way the hair is done, and the hands, it looks like an older woman. Someone maybe in their 50s or 60s. If you look at photographs of Bill Reed's mother, sorry, a not so older woman. Woo! Okay, put the other one in your mouth, Tim. Okay. That, so that image just became imprinted on my mind. I went and looked at her every day, because really, obviously her. And later I discovered that it's most likely his mother. If you look at portraits of his mother, and I actually stood there one day holding up a book, you know, and it's pretty clear that it's a caricature of his mother. There's other evidence, too, that it's not a man. The original carving, of course, was not so monolithic. It was, in fact, a handheld box carving. And I had the privilege of meeting a young, a woman who, as a little girl, lived in the same house as Bill Reed in Montreal when he carved this handheld sculpture. And it's very small. It's about this big. And it explains why he would be carving the faces upside down and so on, because he could just move it around in his hand, you know, and carve it upside down if he wanted. That's another view of it. And if you look very close, and see, in this small one, it kind of looks like the people are little slugs, like grubs crawling out of the clamshell. There's the little babies hanging up. And if you look real, and oh yeah, and the markings on the wing, the raven markings, traditional. And if you look very closely, hidden at the back, this is in a case, hidden in one corner of the museum, and they positioned it so that at the very back of this little exhibit, if you sort of cock your head very carefully, you can see this. That is the woman that I'm referring to as the mother, with a librette in her lip, which of course was removed from the second version, out of, I think, respect for the legend, so that it could be legitimately called Raven and the First Men. But you can see that it initially was clearly a woman. So, now I can talk about the music, now that we've sort of looked at the sculpture. Here's my movement structure for the piece of music. In many ways, I felt, because it was a handheld carving initially, that a series of miniatures would make sense. Just little pieces about the size of something you fit in your hand. And of course, the characters are very cartoon-like, and so I was inspired by the idea of very dramatic gestures that leap out of the ensemble, much like, you know, watching a cartoon. You can see from this list that there's three movements that are called Bird Sanctuary. And that essentially is my little sketches that I would do actually sitting in the museum, looking at the sculpture because it really was. It was a bird sanctuary for me. Then the second movement is called Hands, and was inspired by the images of the hands that are, like, hands, of course, are the most difficult thing to sculpt, and they're brilliantly represented. And then the faces in the clamshell, of course, is movement four. That's inspired by the characters themselves. And the last movement, six, is dedicated to the raven, and it's called Flight. Okay, I'll show you some shots of the score. So I mentioned that circular figures are very significant in the Northwest Coast art. And it's not surprising because I think when you go for a walk in the morning or afternoon on the beach or even in the woods, you become very, very aware of the tides. The ocean really does impress itself upon you. One experience that I think really struck me is the lowest possible tide. Because the tide doesn't go all the way out every day. And if you haven't ever had the opportunity to do this, you'd strap on some rubber boots. And at the lowest point in the tide, you can walk out on Spanish Banks, which is right near where I was living, or am living. You can walk out a good 2, even 3 kilometers into the ocean, into what is water normally. And what's there is the belly of undersea creatures, starfish, you know, fish flopping around, all kinds of urchins and crayfish and so on. And then, of course, birds having a field day with a buffet that's in front of them. And lots of ravens, eagles, hawks. So it's just a magnificent experience. You're surrounded by this natural occurrence that's like a big celebration, a big feast. And in the music, I really felt that the waves of sound were important. And so you can see here, you know, a gesture moving upward to the highest range of the instruments, then moving down, and then the gestures moving up and down quickly, and then the sort of gradual build up. And then you can see in the texture of the piece of music, you can see waves of sound beginning and ending. So on the top system of that page, there's a wave that kind of peters off, and then it starts up again. And here you see two waves colliding. There's a wave of sound in the very high range. You see the clarinet up at bar 69, 70, where it says chord equals 72. Right in the top range there, the clarinet's producing this very quiet ebb and flow, and then the strings coming underneath that with the pizzicato plucking of those strings, which creates a whole new texture, a whole new sound, and a new wave that comes in. Then, of course, waves on a more microscopic level that undulate quickly. And then waves that build in the undulation as they work towards a crescendo. And then little waves. I don't know if you can see this. It's harder to see, but there's glissandi in there. The lines between the notes on the middle two, the first violin and second violin, the staff that's in the top staff and here in the bottom. It's supposed to be a point with my mouse. There, this stuff. These are like little wavelets, and they make a glassy sound on the instrument. Reminded me of the sound of the rocks when the ocean is coming in. The other thing that struck me about the sculpture is the textures. In addition to being a masterpiece of structure and a vividly dramatic character study, it's also very carefully represented in texture. And so you see the wings of the raven and the way in which each of those individual curves are carefully done. Here again, on the other side, the wing, same idea. See the feathers coming down and the care with which this was made. And then the more abrupt figure, which I started to realize occurs all over the place. And you see this on ravens and eagles all over the place in Northwest Coast art. The curves on the clamshell, beautiful texture. And then here we see the back wing of the raven. It's a fascinating face. And it's upside down, very majestic, broad face. You see the beautiful cedar lines, and of course the feet of the raven. And moving out, we see the markings on the wing. Very significant. Okay. One of the things that I discovered as I was, looks like we're good for time, 15 minutes, great. So I can talk now about my walks a little bit and how some of that worked its way into the music. Because my objective originally was not to write a piece of music about Bill Reid's sculpture, but to write about my experience of living on the West Coast. And so these are some of the totemic images that you see outside of the Museum of Anthropology. And it came to my awareness that the museum itself is a magnificent piece of art as well. And that the sculpture, Bill Reid's sculpture, interacts very actively with the surroundings. Not just the natural surroundings, but with the buildings on the campus and with images like this that you see on one of the smaller totem poles. This is one of the totem ravens that you see outside. Another angle on it, and you can see the markings on the wing and the long beak. And then you start to notice that there's kind of a language to all of this. I mean, in many ways, I came to this sort of like an anthropologist, right? Like a participant observer. I knew nothing about it. I was completely ignorant. And so all of this was kind of a storytelling that I had to grasp at in visual images. And what became clear to me is that these images are very sophisticated and complex language that is all part of a tradition of storytelling, that these figures speak volumes if you understand how to interpret them. And all of that is just sitting there outside on the campus, and often people walk by it without taking any notice, as if it had no significance whatsoever. So this, you see the tongue protruding, that's a common motif. There's another raven beak. There's a beaver, the long teeth. Another beaver, and another beaver. Bear, another bear, and the frog. I love the frog. Frog always seems to be coming out of someone's mouth. For various reasons that I've learned about, but okay. So that gives you some idea of some of the images that surround the museum itself. The other story that I became aware of at the Museum of Anthropology is that it's a museum of anthropology for many cultures, not just for Northwest Coast culture. In fact, it's a museum of anthropology for more recent history as well. The museum is built on a site that was, in fact, not a university at one time. It was a site used for defense. Because Vancouver, of course, is a very strategic place to attack in the case of a war, and it's a very good place to look out over the water to see if people are coming. And so even hundreds of years ago, it was used for defense. And so when we look at the museum itself, to take, for example, this image, that's the famous Arthur Erickson design, right? And I was walking by, my first week there, I was walking by this, and I saw this shape, and there was this tourist from Germany sort of beside me, and he said hi, and then he sort of blurted out to me, "It's a bunker!" He was a little shocked by that. Of course, living in Canada, we don't see bunkers very often, but it's clear that this is a direct reference to a war, kind of architecture used in war. The other thing you notice is the post and beam construction, right? The pillars that go upwards and then the beam across. So that's interesting. Where did that come from? Well, it appears that from pictures, we can see that the totem poles were used as structural elements in the buildings. And so here's an example of a building or a gateway or a doorway with two totem poles holding it up. And then here's a picture inside, holding up the roof of the building. So getting back to the score and the sort of the structure that I was talking about earlier, in many ways, the bird sanctuaries for me became like the pillars of the piece of music, the structural markers holding it up. And what's in between are these very expressive movements. So the bird sanctuaries are like birds. It's bird calls. It's little peeps in the forest popping out of the texture, whereas the movements in between are like the expressive gestures of the textures, the waves, the emotions on the faces. So we can have a little bit of fun with this. I brought along some recordings of some birds. I'll play them. And you can do a guessing game later on if maybe you'll hear some of these in the piece of music. And these are just some birds that I heard in the woods around the museum. Some of you will probably recognize what they are. Which we see as a ubiquitous motive in the building. It's everywhere. There it is again. This is the front. Again, that motive. Repetition, cycles, moving out from the center. The other thing that's interesting is that you can see that there's a great deal of effort in the architecture to create an illusion that there's no boundary between outside and inside. When you look at this from this angle, you can see these posted beam structures. You don't really see the glass in between, which separates the two worlds. Then there's this. They took great care to preserve this piece of anthropology, this piece of history, this artifact. This is, of course, what the building is built on. It's an ammunition canister, or a place where you store ammunition, shells, cartridges, shells, and of course, the bunkers, war shelter, gun store. Oh, and the mountains, beautiful in the background. That's, of course, the meticulously preserved war memorial there, with a totem pole in the background. And then one more thing that I'd like to point out is some images of the, that's what it actually looked like in the 19-teens. And here's a little map. So here we have the three howitzers that would have pointed out to the ocean, the beach, and the museum itself is built around the middle one, which was removed. The two on the outside were preserved. And Bill Ruth's sculpture sits right on the place where that gun was. So obviously it's an artifact commemorating peace. These are the towers that still exist on the beach, what is now called the Tower Beach, which would have illuminated the ships coming in to ward them off. And then this is one final gesture in the architecture that really fascinated me, and that is very musical in a way, and in some ways got me thinking about this whole cyclic idea of the cycles moving outward. I'm standing pretty much in the middle of the, with my camera, in the middle of the gun, and this is what I see. So the trajectory of that motive as it moves out through the building follows the trajectory of the shell, which would be projected out onto the ocean. That caught me by surprise. And it made me wonder if he was trying to say something with that. It was from the other side. There's a kind of culture being projected from the museum. When you look at this facade from the inside, you can see that the totem poles are, in fact, doorposts. They stand in the same place structurally as the literal beams which hold the roof up. And so they symbolically play the role of doorposts, which raises the question, of course, as to where the door actually is. There is an entrance on the other side, it's very tiny, which resembles this. But this, of course, is really the main entrance, this glass window. It begs the question of who would come visit the museum through a pane of glass. Again. And of course, the imagery associated with Bill Reith's sculpture and the Northwest Coast art in general has projected itself out onto our Canadian landscape, onto our stamps, our institutions, and of course, our money. It's our $20 bill and Bill Reith's self-portrait. Quite a trickster. Good trick, Bill. And this final little image, it's not the greatest resolution, but this is another sculpture of Bill Reith's that I find incredible. And it is a tongue sculpture. In light of the fact that this image is poor, I'll just describe it. There's a series of characters where the tongues protrude from the mouth and engage each other. One tongue leaps into the mouth of another. Bill Reith himself described this, these tongues as a kind of exchange of cultures. And basically the idea being, it's through art and through these representations, these abstract representations of what's underneath our cultures, that we communicate most richly and most honestly. I think that's sort of what he was trying to say with the Raven and the First Man, and with that sculpture. And I think he succeeded. I think one last thing that I'll mention is, if you have a look at the $20 bill, I don't know how many of you have one on you, but there's actually a quote on there. And it's by a very famous Canadian author. Does anyone know what I'm talking about, this quotation? Somebody must know it. Can someone read it for me from the bill itself? And read who said it. I don't know. I didn't bring any money up on stage with me, so. Go for it. Volunteer. Someone articulate. You can't read it? It's too dark. Can someone read it? Go for it, if you can. Too small. That's right, yeah. That's right. Written by a very famous Canadian author. Could we ever know each other in the slightest without the arts? A very appropriate statement shared in common with Bill Gates' work. So I hope you enjoyed the piece of music today, which very much, to me, reflects all of this art that we can call, I think, Canadian art, and that extends the process of this trajectory of cultural exchange. Thank you.